Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner, founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And you know, we all know, we keep hearing this over and over again, that elegance wins in the marketplace. That products like this, the iPhone, are winning. They're kicking butt, not because they have more features, but because they're more elegant than the competition. So the question I have is, how do you design elegance? How can you intentionally create a product that is elegant? And to learn how to do that, I invited Matthew May on Mixergy. He is the author of this book, In Pursuit of Elegance, and he came on Mixergy to talk about how you can create elegant products. In this program, you're going to hear us talk about the four elements of elegance, and I'll give them to you right now, but of course we'll go into depth about them in the program itself. They are symmetry, seduction, subtraction, and sustainability. Symmetry, seduction, subtraction, and sustainability. You'll hear a lot more about those in this program and how they'll help you create a more elegant product. We also talked about the common mistake that you are probably making right now that's keeping your product from being elegant. And by the way, I've made that mistake myself, and you'll hear me talk about it in the program too. Finally, you'll hear us talk about, I shouldn't say finally, there's so much more. I'm just giving you a few points that you'll hear in this program. You'll hear about how you can create seductive products. Listen to the experiment that Sony did to figure out how much to reveal if you want your product to be and to come across as seductive. All that, like I said, and so much more in this program. A note about the technology here, we use Skype to connect with each other, and Matthew and I lost our connection a couple of times, and Paola, my new editor, unfortunately had to piece it all back together. Let me know how it came out. If you don't hear it right, if you see an error in the video, tell us and we'll fix it. Tell us in the comments. All right, here's my interview, my full program for you about how you can create elegant products with Matthew May. Matt, why should business people care about elegance?
Business people and everyone should care about elegance because we are in a time and a marketplace and an economy where we need to be able to do more and better with fewer resources. We need to be able to cut through a huge amount of noise out in the marketplace, be able to make our products, our services stand out. And elegance is the combination of two things, sort of super simplicity and surprising impact. And when you're able to come up with an idea that engages people by leaving something out, it draws them in, helps them become a creator of the idea, you help that idea stick and you help it spread, and they become part and parcel to your products and services. And it's a valuable thing to engage in.
Do you have an example of a product that shows elegance well? I mean, we all know the iPod, we all think of the iPhone, and anything created by Apple as clear examples of elegance. But do you have another example that will illustrate what we're talking about here?
Yeah, there are a number of examples. I mean, when you think about the things that in your life that sort of make you slap your forehead and go, why didn't I think of that? Those are probably pretty elegant things just by virtue of their sheer simplicity. If you look at the Google interface, for example, and compare that even to the new Yahoo homepage. There's a clear difference in simplicity, in design, in the fact that, gosh, there's really only one thing you can do when you go to that Google homepage. You know exactly where you want to head. It is a pull. You are engaging with that interface. Yet when you go to, say, the YouTube, I'm sorry, not YouTube, the new Yahoo page, it's still a bit of a push. They're still sort of telling you what to do, and there's a lot of stuff on that page, and your eyes are scanning all over the place. Twitter. You know, we're on Twitter right now. I think that that's a perfect example of something that is elegant. You got 140 characters. It requires you to constantly edit your thoughts, leave room for retweets. It leaves open other providers to co-create and build things that work with the basic Twitter service. That's what elegance is really all about. It's a super simple idea, but the impact right now is shocking.
Okay, and you've gotten your book, and I'll hold it up so people can see it, In Pursuit of Elegance. What a great title, by the way. You've got four elements of elegance, and I thought we can use that as the outline for the conversation and start talking about each one individually, starting with symmetry. What is symmetry in relation to elegance?
Well, symmetry First of all, I should tell you that my framework for elegance, those four elements, I really didn't come up with them. I give credit to the individual who's thought to be the father of computer programming, computer science. That's Donald Knuth at Stanford. And he said something is elegant if it's symmetrical, spare, pleasingly memorable, and has the ease and immortal ring of an E equals MC squared. So I sort of massaged those elements, and I wanted to use a little bit of alliteration. So symmetry actually comes from science and mathematics. And it's not about mirror reflections, left-right balance, or anything like that. Symmetry is a very simple concept, and it's this. A few simple rules, non-negotiable rules, that when fed back on themselves repeatedly, create these wonderful patterns of order and organization. And it's the simplest of rules that create the most complex and beautiful and well-running, effective organizations. And if whether you're talking about companies, whether you're talking about products, the use of symmetry is a valuable thing. And designers, for instance, know the value of symmetry and asymmetry. If you want to get someone's attention, leave a bit of the symmetry out. It draws us in because we're symmetry seekers. So it's a valuable way, an elegant way to get someone's engagement, create intrigue and order and effectiveness all at the same time.
By the way, I want to tell people that one of the reasons that I was excited about having you on here is that elegance to me just seems like this, you either got it or you don't concept. And what I loved about your book In Pursuit of Elegance and the way that you taught it is that I may not at the end of the book automatically start spitting elegance out of everywhere, but it gives me a framework and an understanding that at least lets me recognize why something feels elegant. And beyond that, if I'm trying to add some elegance, I know where to get started. I know what to focus on. And I'm not just staring at a blank canvas trying to figure it all out, or staring at a blank web page trying to figure out how do I make this elegant. And that's why I want to just keep going into the how to, the understanding of what the framework is. All right. And you gave an example of someone who I would think of as the least symmetric, least organized artist. You're smiling because you know I'm talking, of course, about Jackson Pollock. I've got a Jackson Pollock print here that looks to me like absolute chaos. And you pointed out that it's not chaos. Can you tell people why? Well, first of all, for anyone who doesn't know what Jackson Pollock is, what is his artwork like? And then let's explain how there's symmetry there.
Okay. Well, they made Hollywood made a pretty big movie with Ed Harris out of it called Pollock. But he was called by Life magazine Jack the Dripper. And if you don't know who Pollock is, you look at his paintings, which some of them go up to $30, $40 million sale price. They look like just a kid who has taken not a brush, but a can of paint or a stick and just splattered it at the canvas. Well, that's not exactly true. As a matter of fact, a lot of people have tried to replicate what he has done, and they've been unsuccessful. And the reason they've been unsuccessful is because there's a special kind of symmetry that only he was able to employ, and it's called a fractal. And a fractal is, it's like a snowflake. You know, they're infinitely repeating patterns. Very simple rule creates this complexity out of chaos. And really, it's the fingerprint of nature. If you think about waves, if you think about trees, if you think about roots, they're all, as you zoom in on different magnifications of those things, they look the same. And that's the nature of symmetry. If there's something you can do to it so that after you've done it, it looks the same, then it's symmetrical. And so what Pollock was able to do was sort of channel nature, and his paintings are fractal. In other words, a physicist has actually scanned his paintings into a computer and zoomed in 100 times on the paint, and it retains its complexity even when you zoom in on it. Well, now that's a fascinating thing, because that no one else has been able to do that. And if you look at the paint around, because he used to lay his canvas on the floor when he did his paintings, if you look at the splats and drips around the canvas on the floor of the barn that he painted on, they're not fractal. So something was going on, and it's sort of a fascinating thing. And I made the tie between Pollock and traffic, of all things.
Yes. Well, before we even go to traffic, sounds great. It sounds to me, what you said about Jackson Pollock, like maybe it's just happenstance. Maybe we just like his work because he's dripping, and dripping goes against what we've seen in art before, and that's the only reason we like it. And this whole fractal thing, I was thinking for a while there, maybe Matt just made it up. Maybe Matt just saw something that wasn't there. And then you had this experiment that was done by Richard Taylor, who created two different kinds of Pollock impersonations, right? Can you tell people about the experiment that he did and the results?
Well, you know, he was asking the very first question you asked at the top of the interview. So what? You know, what's the so what of that? Well, the so what is, if there is something special about a Pollock painting, that's sort of huge, because that specialness, perhaps we can learn something from it. And yeah, he had people do paintings using the same techniques, dripping paint from sticks and cans. And to the naked eye, they, for all intents and purposes, looked just like a Pollock. But when put next to a Pollock, the people that had the greatest satisfaction in viewing went to the Pollock. There was something calming about the Pollock painting that wasn't there in the other drip patterns, and those drip patterns didn't retain their complexity. And it's like sitting down in front of a fire. It's like listening to the waves crash on the ocean. It's like looking up to the stars. There was some way that he was able to channel something that is organically pleasing to us. And the so what of that is, you can apply those principles to business.
How?
Well, for example, I spend a lot of time with a company called Toyota. And they have a lot of factories and they have a lot of warehouses. And factories and warehouses in general are plagued by a problem called absenteeism. And a lot of companies have that problem. Well, a lot of, not Toyota factories, but other manufacturers will hire absentee coordinators, absentee controllers, if you will. They'll lurk behind, you know, they have their clipboard, and they'll lurk behind corners and pillars and, you know, track the comings and goings of people.
All right, so let's pick it up where we left off. I think you were talking about absenteeism and how Toyota adopted General Motors plant and had to deal with some of their absentee issues.
Yeah, instead of by the way, how am I looking?
It's coming across really well. It may be even better than it did before.
Okay. Instead of having, you know, people walking around trying to control comings and goings of people, absenteeism, which was at 20%, they adopted two very, very simple, non-negotiable agreements, core values, if you will, respect for people and continuous improvement. And they left open to interpretation what those meant. They told stories and gave examples, but they didn't define it. And so people were left to come up with their own definition of what respect for people meant, what continuous improvement meant. Within 2 years of taking over that plant, absenteeism was down to about 3%. And they replaced 5,000 union grievances with about 9,000 ideas the very first year. Same people not showing up for work, said, here's the deal, respect for people, continuous improvement, and dramatic turnaround. And that's sort of the business equivalent of a Pollock painting, if you will.
So how does that illustrate symmetry in business? Doesn't that just say that if you don't have a lot of rules and you trust people, then things will work out?
Well, that goes back to the definition of symmetry. And again, what we have stuck in our mind is that symmetry is about a characteristic that we can see. Like if you look at something in the mirror, it looks the same. If you reflect half your face in the mirror, you get the whole
person.
That's
what I think of symmetry, exactly.
And that's just an example. But the underlying rule or the underlying definition is that something is symmetrical if there's something you can do to it so that after you've done it, it looks the same. And in order to achieve that, it has to be a very, very simple rule that arises not out of order, but out of chaos. And that rule gets fed back on itself. You create a snowflake by taking a line segment, cutting it in three, drawing two line segments, and keep repeating that pattern. As a matter of fact, if you were to go do a Google search on the Mandelbrot fractal, or even on your iPhone, you can get an iPhone app that's the Mandelbrot fractal. As you zoom in on it, it's the same thing. And what drives that is the notion of simple rules, not onerous regulations, but simple rules, creating the kind of order that you really want. And so it doesn't look symmetrical in the factory. It is an example of how simple rules create better order.
Okay,
That makes sense.
I think it might help then here to talk about the traffic example that you were going to give earlier.
Okay. All
Can
right.
you tell people what they did that's different from what I'm seeing here at any intersection in Santa Monica?
Sure. In some places in the Netherlands, some very, very high traffic intersections, they have employed design principles to eliminate all of the traffic controls, all the signage, all of the lights, all of the traditional things we think about that are necessary in order to protect us and create better traffic flow. What they've done is to create what's called a shared space where there's absolutely no right of way. So you come into some of these intersections, and there are like 20,000 cars going through there on a daily basis. You come into these intersections where the curbs have become the same height as the street. They're cobblestoned. There are trees, cafe tables out right in the middle of where you think you should be driving. There are fountains. There are cars, trucks, buses, trolleys, walkers, going every which way, and it looks like total chaos. And what has happened is that they have doubled their traffic flow and cut their accidents in half. Because you come into these intersections that are completely uncertain and ambiguous, and what do you immediately do? Because you don't know what to do. You slow down. And because there's no right of way, you start looking at the other people and what they're doing. And while traffic doesn't flow fast, there are no accidents because you're looking out for yourself and for the other person. And what you're really after, which is great order, great effectiveness, greater flow, and a safer environment, is achieved not by all the traffic controls that make us stop thinking, but by things that take things away and make us think more. And that's what elegance is all about. It's about injecting the people that are involved into the equation rather than taking them out of the equation.
All right, and that leads to another element of elegance, which is subtraction. And I have a similar experience to actually, I was building a website and people didn't understand how to interact with one of my pages. So I added more words and they still didn't get it. So I added a clearer description, another description on top of it, and they still didn't get it. And so I added a description of every form field, of every element. You could put your mouse over anything and get a description of what it was. And I just kept adding. And you say that that's the natural tendency to add. But elegance is about subtracting. And you gave an example of it here, but you gave several others in your book. And let me see if I could find the best one here. Or do you have a favorite example that we can use to illustrate this, or should I pick one out?
Well, my favorite one is the one I started the book with, which is the last episode of The Sopranos. But I don't know if everyone saw the last episode of The
Well, if they
Sopranos.
didn't, they probably saw it on the news. I don't think we're going to be giving anything away when we say how it ends.
I actually got a comment of someone who read the book, and they said, "Oh my gosh, he gave away the ending to The Sopranos." And it's 2 years past. But my favorite example is the last episode of The Sopranos, where they completely ended the 8 year run of a hugely popular series that everybody was looking forward to seeing whether Tony Soprano, who's the head of a sort of a loosely run mob crew in northern New Jersey, whether he's going to get whacked or not. You know, half the audience wanted to see him, you know, get it, and the others wanted to see him go on and perhaps there'd be a feature film. Well, gosh, at the end of right when we think the climax is going to happen, everybody's screen went blank. I mean, totally black. And everybody hit their TV saying, you know, what happened to my cable? And then the credits rolled. And then within 24, and everybody cried foul. You know, Jon Stewart made fun of it on the Daily Show. The media went crazy crying foul, but David Chase came out within 24 hours and said, "Everything you need to know about the conclusion to the story is in that last episode." And so people went back and they looked at their TiVos. They dissected scene by scene all the hidden clues that he had embedded, past show references, lighting, things he had done with lighting, with sound, with songs, with stuff people were wearing, And to this day, if you were to go to YouTube and do a search on Sopranos final episode, you'll find two or three viewer-supplied endings. And people supplied they came up with their own ending to it, and it got triple the viewership because there was no ending. Any traditional ending, we would have gotten probably the 12 million people that were signed up to watch it anyway. He got 30 million plus people to watch that last show by leaving something out.
And that's what it is about. In fact, maybe this is even an example of seduction, one of the other elements that you talk about, that when you leave something out, people want to fill in the gaps themselves.
Yeah, and that's because we are symmetry seekers. We look for the symmetry, and part of symmetry is this completeness. And if we don't see it, we will fill it in. We hate, it's nature abhors a vacuum. Our brains hate the vacuum, and so you can exploit that, especially if you're in marketing or business or advertising. Some of the greatest commercials out there. You think about the Apple commercials where you don't see a lot of product. I don't know if you saw that commercial for Cadbury a couple years ago, where whether it was a guy in a gorilla suit, listening to Phil Collins's song "In the Air Tonight," and then just goes crazy on a drum set, and you only see the product for 3 seconds at the end. But it increased sales 10%. One of the most downloaded videos on YouTube. And so when you create that vacuum, when you create that void, it draws people in.
Right, so the four elements of elegance that you talk about in your book in Pursuit of Elegance are symmetry, seduction, subtraction, and sustainability, right? Okay, so
Yes.
we talked about symmetry. We hinted a little bit at subtraction and seduction. Maybe we should then zoom in on seduction and try to really explain how it works. And you gave a couple of examples there, but I thought that maybe the example that really resonated with me was about the QV product that Sony pretended to create. Can you tell people what QV was, what that whole experiment was?
This was back in the late 90s, and a couple of marketing research scientists were trying to figure out in the early days of advertising on the web, how do you create viewership with ads? How do you create interest in a product on the internet? And they ran an experiment for a video camera, a digital camera. It was called the Sony QV, and they created three different ads. It's sort of like what you just described, where it was all the information you could possibly want on this product, all the features, all the benefits, all the technical specifications. And they created another ad that said it was nothing more than a new Sony product, a digital product. The middle ad said that it was a Sony digital camera, listed a little bit of information about it, and then they tracked all the click-throughs. And all of the pull that those three ads created, and the one that created the greatest number of interest, greatest hits, greatest click-throughs, greatest interest in the product was the one in the middle, where it wasn't complete information, but it was just enough to whet our appetite, to get us interested, create some curiosity, create a gap, and people went to fill in that gap to satisfy their curiosity. But on the two extremes, there wasn't nearly as much interest. And so that's the notion of seduction. If you're thoughtful about limiting certain kinds of information, you create more intrigue and engagement at that pull.
And you actually have a great quote in the book from Soman and Menon. Am I pronouncing their names right?
You are, and those are the two scientists that were conducting the
Okay,
experiment.
and I've got a little bit of a cold here, but I've got to read this to people. They say, arouse curiosity by demonstrating a moderate gap in the observer's knowledge, then provide just enough information to make them want to resolve their curiosity. And thirdly, give them time to try to resolve their curiosity on their own. And those are the three. That's the formula for creating seduction.
And that's exactly what David Chase did with that episode of The Sopranos, if you think about it. He did all of those three things with a masterful touch.
It's just enough that they want more. And let's see, let me go through it again. Arouse curiosity by demonstrating a gap in the observer's knowledge, provide just enough information to make them want to resolve their curiosity, and then give them time to resolve their curiosity on their own. And that's a mistake that I made with that web page that I was telling you about. I was adding more and more and more and more because I didn't give them room to be curious and to satisfy the curiosity on their own. I was trying to shove the answer in their face.
Yeah, and you think about our products and services out there that you have in your own life, right? We're always getting more features, more benefits. Many of them don't work. Many of them we don't know how to use. One of the things I love to do when I talk to people in groups is to flash up the Google interface, and then I flash up the Microsoft Word interface, and I've got all of my toolbars out in the open. Have you ever done that? Go under View and get all your toolbars out from Microsoft Word. You got about an inch left of space for the primary value-adding feature of Word, which is to write. 80% of the things that are built in, we don't know about, we don't use, and we don't understand. And that leads you to the element of subtraction, which is about restraint from addition, from getting rid of the things that don't add value from a customer's perspective. So once you understand what a customer really truly wants, needs, requires, systematically go about plucking out the things that get in the way of real value.
All right, let's now move on to subtraction. By the way, actually, before we do, how do you know what that key value is? Do you bring customers in? Do you send out surveys? Is there a way of doing that?
One of the things that I learned in writing this book that has stayed with me. The real takeaway for me was the power of observation. And that observation really is not just asking someone what they want. And the reason that has to go beyond that is because, well, gosh, you're a consumer. And when you get the phone call at dinner time and someone's asking your opinion about an experience or a product that you've just bought, what is it that you're trying to do as an answer to
Get
that
off the
call? You're
phone.
trying to get off. Exactly, and you'll say anything. Well, you know, sometimes in focus groups, that happens, but more importantly, as consumers, A, we don't always know what we want, or we can't articulate it. We're going to change our minds next week, and we're not probably going to tell you the truth even if you ask us. So, you've got to get out and you've got to become the customer. You've got to become an undercover cop. And you've got to involve them in the design of things. And one of the lessons I learned from Toyota was how to do that with the new millennials, the Gen Ys of the world, because they had failed in trying to market the Toyota brand to the 18 to 24-year-olds, because that's what mom drives. And you know, they had slick marketing, put it on cell phones, but nobody was buying the Toyota brand if you were a young person. And so they needed a new product. And what did they do? They went out and they attended raves. I mean, that's a visual, right? I mean, marketing execs from Toyota in suits going to a rave to try and figure out what these young folks really wanted. And they walked away with a single theme: personal expression. You see it in the piercings, you see it in the tattoos. People these days like to do stuff to their stuff. And so they came up with an extremely spare vehicle. The Scion XB looks like a little toaster. Made it very spare and very customizable, priced it at $15,000, and lo and behold, the young folks gravitated to it. The thing flew off the dealer lots, and they would put another 15 grand into the car. And where I live out here in Thousand Oaks, there was a lot, an empty lot. You could go on a Saturday morning, see 15 to 20 of these things lined up. It had nothing to do with the car. It had to do with what I did to my car. I got a flat panel in the back. You take a look at my sound system, my carbon fiber dash. I can download a video, burn it on my DVD, and you can watch it in your car. So that's the thought behind subtraction is understand that by getting out into the marketplace and observing. And I really that's a lesson that I learned in writing this book.
So observing is how you figure out what that core want is. But I've got to tell you, I've been to raves. There's so many other elements that I could have picked up on there. I could have picked up on, for me, energy. They're drinking energy drinks, they're taking pills that will pep them up, they're jumping up and down to the music. Everything about that experience could have sent me home thinking they want energy. Let's give them a fast car. I could also convince you that there are other elements that maybe stood out more than energy, like
Yeah, and
sex.
that's why. Yeah, and I didn't tell the whole story. They also attended urban art shows and extreme sporting events. And they would take prototypes of the product and place it in those venues to watch the reaction. And so it was an iterative process. They didn't just go to a rave and say, okay, all these kids are all about personal expression. No, they had, you know, they had designers, marketers, engineers to try and decode all of that from a number of experiences. And then they would watch the reaction and get suggestions and almost have the intended audience act as co-creators or co-designers of the eventual product. So it's more complex than the broad brush that I just painted. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you can't just go to one single event and walk away with a conclusion and then try and trounce something out to the marketplace. It won't work.
Okay, but the main idea is you've got to go into the marketplace to figure it out. You can't sit back and do research by phone or by survey. You have to watch.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, back to the traffic thing, I spoke to an urban designer by the name of Ben Hamilton Bailey, and he said something pretty profound. He said, if we were to simply observe first and design second, we wouldn't build half of the things that we do. And the thought behind it is there's an awful lot of things already going on in the world. And if we're careful about our observation, and we do those things, we observe our customer, we become our customer, we involve them in the design, sometimes all of our design bias, if focused the right way, gets mitigated by the fact that it's really something very simple that our customer wants. And we just have to get smart about understanding what that is. And one of my favorite examples is here in Southern California, In-N-Out Burger.
I love them. I love them. By the way, when I first moved to Southern California, got off the plane, rented my car on my way to my hotel room or to try to figure out where I was going to stay, I went and I found an In-N-Out Burger just so I could get a burger there. Now, I took my girlfriend there. I took Olivia to In-N-Out Burger, and she looked at the menu, and the first thing she saw was what wasn't there. It's a really small menu, right?
Yeah, it's like four items. You have a hamburger, a cheeseburger, a double-double, which is two patties, two slices of cheese, French fries, and then shakes and drinks. That's it, and it hasn't changed in 60 years.
And that's an example of elegance because it's so simple.
It is, but what is... you know, where I tell the story in the book is in the part of subtraction. Subtraction can mean restraint from adding. In other words, they didn't go down the McDonald's route where, you know, you have salads, where you have pizza, where you have all these complex things. However, what they do have is a secret menu. And I don't know if you know about the secret menu, but it's got triple the number of items on there. But the company hasn't come up with them. The In-N-Out customers have, and the funny thing is they adopt them as standards and they show up on your receipt. Like if you were to go in today and order a Flying Dutchman from an In-N-Out Burger, which is nowhere on the menu, you would be greeted with a plate that's got simply the burger and cheese and no bun. It's out in the open right there. That's why it's a Flying Dutchman, no bun, and on your receipt would read Flying Dutchman.
You know, that's another thing that I've noticed about elegant products and companies, that they're hidden options that you only get to discover when you're really immersed in the product. Like when I first got my MacBook Pro, which is what I'm talking to you on, I looked at it. I said, one mouse button. They don't have many keys here. There's no home key. There's no delete key. That was really bothersome to me. Actually, there's a delete key, but it's really the backspace key. So they don't have backspace and delete the way you do on a PC. But the more I got into it, the more I realized that there are hidden features here, that there is a right mouse button or the equivalent of it, that there is a way to get the delete and the backspace to work. You just have to know how to do it. In-N-Out Burger, you just gave an example of that. Earlier, you talked about Google. It's very deceptively simple. You've got just that search bar. It seems like you can't do much. But once you get smart and once you get immersed in the product, you realize that you can type site colon and then a URL followed by what you're looking for and search for that keyword just within the site that you're looking in. You could type define colon and then a word and get a definition of that word. So they have a lot of these features that their competition has, but they hide them and they present just a simple, clean look. Is that something that's unique to these three companies that I talked about, or is it a part of elegant design?
It's part of elegant design because if you think about it, think about the excitement with which you just sort of described your ability to do all these things. You discovered those things. They're now yours. It was a cool thing that you discovered. And what are you probably going to do? You're probably going to tell others about it. It's a much more powerful, and Twitter's the same way. Think about all the things people are discovering about what you can do with Twitter. But the basic service is so very simple. And that's a lesson, I think, for all of us, no matter, you know, what our product, service, walk of life is that allow that discovery to happen. And that is elegance, because elegance really is about having this surprising power and this aha moment for your users, for your audience. Allow them to discover those things, and it bonds your customers and users to you in a way that you couldn't have come up with on your own by giving them all those things right away. Allow them to discover them. They inject their intellect, their energy, and they're now invested in your product and your service in a unique way.
All right, I'm a little anal, so I want to see how that, what you and I just talked about, how it fits within your framework. Which of these elements does it fall under? Is it all of them? Is it one of them? Did I discover another element that you wish you'd included in the book, and now you're going to go back and create a second edition with Andrew's injection?
It's a bit of all of them, because symmetry is about having very, very, very simple rules. Seduction is about limiting information, which is what you just talked about, right? And subtraction is the act with which those things occur. So it's the laws of subtraction that sort of govern the ideas of simple rules and limited information. So it's a bit of all of those things. And it's very difficult to separate all of those. You only do it in a book, really.
I see. All right. Fair enough. Another example of subtraction in action is a company called First Direct. What is First Direct, and how did they do subtraction well?
They're a bank, and a British bank, and owned by First Midland. And they, back a decade ago, they did something that would have been put on our front page of the Wall Street Journal as a bad news item. As a matter of fact, yesterday I read Bank of America is closing X percent of its branches. Well, First Direct decided never to have branches, just to close all of them. And they got out into the marketplace, and they spent time with their customers and discovered that people truly hated going to the bank. There was nothing about the experience that was truly pleasurable, and it was a bias that bankers had that people wanted this relationship. Well, they didn't. So they became Britain's first branchless bank. Everything was telebanking, and now it's, you know, on the internet. It became one of the most highly reputable banks in Great Britain, in the United Kingdom, and most profitable. But they entirely removed branches. The thing that we all think about when we think about banks is a branch. They got rid of it.
I love that. And really, for me, I don't need the branches. I wish that I didn't have the branches. All right. There's another example, and I'll give this example. Tell me if I'm wrong. Lance Armstrong got as good as he could, competed, and then he realized that in order to compete with the – and was winning Tour de France. Maybe I should let you give this example.
That's okay. Keep
going. You know what it is? I get excited about certain books. I love your book. I love how it's full of examples, and then I just want to jump in here and tell your own examples. And as I'm going through, I said, people don't tune in to hear Andrew Warner give Matthew May's examples. They want to hear you, the author, give the example. I'm not even giving your examples. I'm not doing them justice.
Give me your interpretation
okay,
of it.
Okay, you want to see if I caught the idea. So here it is. The guy wins, right? He wins a few Tour de France's, or Tours de France, I bet, is what it's called. And then the competition gets harder. There are younger guys that he has to compete with. He could have gone out and done more work, more exercise. He could have trained even harder and more frequently. But instead, what they decided to do was train less, by figuring out where was the optimal point for him and not going beyond that, not having him out there more hours, but saying, this is where we need to cut back, this is where we need to stop, and stop right there, right? That anything beyond that takes away from his abilities.
And I think your description is probably more elegant and eloquent than mine. I would have become too detailed, and I would have added too much information, and that's exactly right. Instead of, 8 hours on the bike, they could accomplish the same using a little bit of technology and finding the optimal training points. And it became about, half the time spent on the bike, but spent in the right way, you get more and better results because of it. So, yeah,
All
perfect.
right. Right on, people. I don't even know that I need to have Matthew, when you write your next book, I may not even need to have you here. I will just sit here and spit with Olivia in the other room. I would just keep spitting out all the examples. And you could sit at home and watch me on Ustream Live.
There you go.
finally, sustainable. That's the last element here. What does it mean?
Well, gosh, it's become a movement, right? When you hear the word sustainability anymore, you think of the environment. But I think there's a broader definition. All of us have a challenge, and that is to maintain anything at a certain level, irrespective of what it is we're involved in. That's what sustainability really is all about. And it's a pretty easy definition. But the implications, I think, are more important, and that is resource constraints are the things that spur creativity and innovation. You think about all the bad stuff going on right now in the economy, and we're throwing all this money at these solutions. We don't know if they're going to really work or not. And the question on everyone's mind right now is, hey, is this sustainable? Where are we getting all this money from? Can we just keep printing all of this stuff? And sustainability is how do you achieve the optimum effect or the maximum effect with the minimum of means or the minimum of resource input. And quite frankly, it's about thinking inside the box more than thinking outside of the box. And I gave a couple of examples in the book of where some very simple solutions, yet world-changing solutions in Africa have come about. And if you think about sustainability is really sort of an outcome, I think, of a way of thinking about symmetry, seduction, and subtraction. If you get all those things together, you almost can't help but come up with a solution that is far more sustainable than something where you're constantly expending resources.
All right, then I will give one of your examples from the book of Star Video, or am I giving away something? Because I know that you want people to figure that one out for themselves. Maybe we shouldn't.
Yeah, let them figure that one out. But you can certainly tell, Play Pumps International is something I think that everyone perhaps, I mean, they can get on the internet and look at the Play Pumps videos. I mean, it's a very sustainable solution. It's an elegant and easy and simple
What is Play
solution when you
Pumps?
think about it. Play Pumps is it's the very last story in the book, and it's about the fact that in Africa, in many parts of Africa, water is a huge challenge. 6 million people die every day, basically, due to water-related disease or something to do with water. And it's the story of how an advertising executive was in the south, in South Africa, on a fishing expedition, and he walks by a group of women standing around a well. And the well was cracked, and so they were waiting for the wind to blow so that the well could pump water, with a windmill attached to it. It wasn't holding water, so it had to wait for the wind. Well, passed them on a Friday afternoon, came back on a Sunday evening after the weekend with the boys, and they were still standing there. The wind hadn't blown. And that image stuck with him. He went to a trade show in Johannesburg, and he ran across a digger, someone who dug wells, and he had crafted a little toy, and he called it a play pump. And it was a merry-go-round on top of a pump. And all of a sudden, a little bit of serendipity hit, and oh my gosh, here's a brilliant solution, a self-sustaining solution. We use the power of children's play because this digger would go into towns, and he was disturbed by the fact that when he was digging a well, the children would come from miles just to watch him do something because they didn't have any way to play. They didn't have an outlet for their tendency to want to play all day. And so he combined the two absences into a play pump. And the water is 100 feet down, but you drill a pump that's connected to a merry-go-round that children play on, and it provides a constant stream of water. It's stored in a tank, and that tank has four sides to it on which you put public advertising. So the whole thing becomes self-sustaining, and it's become a huge world-changing contraption innovation, if you will. And the Bush administration made note of it, and a lot are on order right now, and there's a lot of subsidies for creating these, but that's a sustainable solution. And that's what it's really all about, is a simple way to do something that really changes some part of someone's life.
Why can't elegance be temporary? Why does it have to last for a long time? Why does sustainability need to be a key element?
Well, I think for the following reason. If you think about, let me give you a, let me put the question back. If you think about all of the things that you would consider to be traditionally elegant, because when you think about elegance, what comes to mind? Diamonds,
Sorry?
perhaps. Diamonds, perhaps. Diamonds
Do you know what? It's
are
now so
elegant.
embedded in my head that when I think of elegance, I always think of anything created by Apple. They feel like, even
Okay.
more than diamonds, I feel like they've just owned that whole word in my life anyway.
Okay. And Apple is sustainable from the standpoint that their design is always has something remarkably clean about it, right? It is essentially a subtractive in the design. There are very few buttons, and the longevity of that company hinges on their ability to design something that is simpler than most of the things out there. So I think that the ability to stay for a long time, E equals MC squared, for example, it still creates debate among physicists.
But if
If
the
it's fleeting.
iPhone lasted for a year and then died because I'd have to buy a new one, wouldn't it still be elegant? Wouldn't it make it even more desirable if it didn't last a long time?
I think that there would be aspects to it that would be elegant. But if no one remembers that iPhone 2 years out and no one uses it, part of elegance is the ability to create an experience and give something simple that has lasting power and impact. That's the way I define it. And so I'm trying to redefine elegance. And so I'm putting it out there that sustainability and the ability to have a classic nature to it. If you think about fashion, we're getting back to the basics. And elegance and classic are always used together. Classic means that there's a timelessness to it. And beyond the product itself, the timelessness aspect to an Apple product is the design aspect itself. And whether the product, it's not about the product being sustainable. It's about the aspect that's of design that is sustainable. I think it's trying to make that distinction, but there's a certain timelessness to it. Otherwise, you are having to use resources, expend resources, constantly new resources, and that flies in the face of the two components to elegance, which are surprising power, but unusual simplicity. And unusual simplicity is the minimization of resources and time and people and materials.
Okay, one more thing.
You buying
I'm
that?
sorry. You know what? I'm
Are you
hesitating
buying
because
that?
I do feel that the Star Video example from your book might explain this. Star Video, I'm not going to give it away. I want people to, if they get the book, to make sure to read the Star Video example. It comes in at the end, or towards the end of the book, and I think it might explain why sustainability needs to be a part of elegance. That Star Video had an issue. They resolved it with a solution that was elegant and was sustainable, and it was meaningful that it was sustainable because it didn't mean that they had to keep coming up with a new solution every day. They came up with a solution one time that just worked forever, for as long as the VCR was a part of their business. Okay, I'm curious about something with the book. One of the reasons that I interviewed you and that I picked up the book is because Guy Kawasaki interviewed you. And then I found out that Guy Kawasaki did a foreword for your book. And now I've got to ask you, how did you get Guy Kawasaki to do the foreword of your book? How'd you meet him?
I wrote a book before this called The Elegant Solution, Toyota's Formula for Mastering Innovation. And someone I worked with at Lexus knew Guy Kawasaki, sent him a copy of the galley of that book. And the guy called me up and he said, I love this book. Do you need a foreword writer? And I said, gosh, I've already got one. And it was the CEO of Saatchi & Saatchi. And that began our relationship. So it was back in 2006. And so this time, when I wrote a book, I remembered him having said that. And so I connected with him, and I said, "Hey, you want to write a foreword to this book?" And he jokingly said, "Yeah, how about a tweet?" And I thought, well, I was just getting into Twitter at the time. It was about 6 months ago. And I thought, you know, there's something elegant about that. What if it's 140 character forward? And so I got back to him. I said, yeah.
And it really was an
40.
elegant solution. He had this simple
Absolutely.
140 character foreword to the book with a little bit of an introduction from him to it. So he put in some effort. And I said at first, wow, guy got away with something. He took a tough job and he found an easy way out of it. And then I realized, no, this really is in keeping with the spirit of the book. All right. Is there anything that I missed in this interview? Anything that you think people should know that I should have asked?
No, I mean it's one of the big idea books, I think, but I think there's a practical way of thinking about it. And I'll leave you with this story that sort of clued me into all of this, and it was the story of Jim Collins, and that's a name that everyone probably in business anyway recognizes. But back in 2003, when I was struggling through some projects at Toyota, I read this essay by Jim Collins in USA Today, and it was about how to create a stop doing list. And it was right before the new year, where we all set our big ambitious goals for the year and our new year's resolutions. Well, he suggested instead of a to-do list, create a stop doing list. And here's a practical way to achieve elegance in whatever you're doing. Come up with all of your goals and objectives just as you normally do, and then get rid of the bottom 20% forever. And just forget about them entirely. And to create a stop doing list is the practical way, I think, to achieve elegance in anything. Get in the habit of getting rid of things that perhaps are at the bottom of the list to begin with, but that don't add value to the things you're really trying to achieve. Make more room for what
All right, I
matters.
love that idea. If you guys are watching us and want to get a stutter-free understanding of these ideas, I think the best way is to go a little old school and pick up a copy of this book. It's In Pursuit of Elegance. It's at the bookstores. It's on Amazon. It's on your website. What's your website? And
InPursuitOfElegance.com.
inpursuitofelegance.com is where you can find all these ideas and more. I urge you to get a copy of the book. Thank you, Matt, for coming on Mixergy.
Hey, thank you very much, and I'm sorry for all the technical difficulties.
And there it is. As always, I'm going to ask you for your feedback because that is the best way for me to connect with you. Every time I ask for feedback, I don't just get great ideas about how to make these programs more valuable for you. And by the way, Mixergy is still small enough that I can listen to and read every single piece of feedback that comes in. But it's also a good way for me to connect with you. If you are somebody who's so ambitious that you're listening to these programs all the way through to the end, then you're the kind of person who I want to meet. And I hope you come back to Mixergy.com. Leave your feedback in any number of places, especially in the comments section of the post where you found this, so that other people can get to know you and that I can get to know you directly too. Second, get a copy of this book, In Pursuit of Elegance. Some of the ideas that we talked about here are better illustrated in the book itself. Finally, click around Mixergy.com. I've got tons of other programs like this one that will help you build a successful company. I'm Andrew Warner. Thank you for watching. I'll see you in the comments.